This is Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. We now turn to a conversation that I had with longtime socialist activist and former vice presidential candidate with the Socialist Party, Eric Chester, about free speech during World War I and why it may matter today. Eric Chester is also a former professor of mathematics, and he is the author of the book that we were in conversation about called Free Speech and the Suppression of Dissent During World War I. We spoke several weeks ago over Skype, in which he joined us from Scotland. Eric Chester, it's my good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Good. It's glad to be here.
What's important to know in these days that we're living in now about this period of time, about World War I, and what was happening really domestically?
Okay, well, World War I was an unpopular war from the start, unlike the Vietnam War, which had some popular support to begin with. There was considerable opposition to the war from the beginning in April 1917, when the United States first entered the war. So from the very start, the administration of Woodrow Wilson had to counter that popular opposition. And to do that, they had to flagrantly violate constitutional norms. So that's really what my book is about, how that happened, the kind of tactics and strategy the administration used, the impact it had on the anti-war opposition, and the legal cases that arose from it.
Tell me about the two main focuses of this book. The two main focuses of your book are the National Civil Liberties Bureau, which is a precursor to the ACLU, and also Eugene Victor Debs. Let's begin with the National Civil Liberties Bureau.
Okay, well, there was a group called the American Union Against Militarism. It was a group of progressives that was opposed to the United States entering the war. This was before the U.S. entered. And so they was a sort of a loose network based in New York, and they mainly did propaganda work and tried to lobby Congress and that kind of stuff. As it became clear that the U.S. was going to enter the war, and that if you continued to oppose the war, you were likely to wind up in jail, they created a Civil Liberties Bureau. And that Civil Liberties Bureau was then set free, independent of the AUAM, and became the National Civil Liberties Bureau. And it just renamed it the American Civil Liberties Union, same organization.
Well, same, so it was just a name change. Yeah, it was just a name change.
Exactly, it was just a name change. So the interesting thing is about the ACLU, rightly so, they say we defend free speech, doesn't matter who it is, whether it's we like the people or not, and that's the correct position. But it is interesting that when it started during World War I, it was started by people who were opposed to the U.S. entering the war, and they provided legal defense for those who were being prosecuted for opposing the war. So it came out of a very specific set of historical circumstances.
Is it all just about opposing the war? I mean, the early 20th century is an intense political moment where we see, you know, really significant worker strikes throughout the country, and even general strikes. And of course, this is after, this is right around the time of the Russian Revolution, which also put the world on notice.
Mm-hmm. That was an intense time. You didn't mention the Socialist Party. You had the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, and they were very much a presence during World War I, grew rapidly and had very effective strikes. In fact, one of the chapters in my book you didn't mention is about the timber workers' strike that the IWW organized and shut down large parts of the timber industry in the Pacific Northwest. At one point, there was probably 10,000 lumber workers involved in the strike. Yes, it was a very intense moment. There was a lot of radical organization. As I said, it was the Socialist Party as well. And in addition to that, there were a lot of progressives out there as there are now. And again, I want to reiterate the important point in terms of the war was the war was unpopular to begin with. And it became even more unpopular when Wilson introduced conscription. That really raised the ante. So you had a situation where there was an organized left, a lot of popular discontent, and an administration that was absolutely committed to fighting the war till the end, till Germany gave up. And that was a clash that was bound to lead to things. And what it led to is a lot of flagrant abuses of civil liberties.
So there is the Espionage Act. This is the Espionage Act of 1917 here in the United States.
Right.
How long is it from the time that the United States gets into the war and we get the Espionage Act? Do they happen at the same time, or perhaps we even had the Espionage Act ahead of entering the war?
No, came directly out of the war, June 1917. So from the point the United States entered the war, Wilson understood that there would be a lot of opposition to it. He authorized the Attorney General to start writing up legislation to deal with it. Charles Warren was Assistant Attorney General, did the actual drafting of it, relying in part on the Dora regulations of Britain, and they were passed by Congress in June of 1917.
Is that the first?
And just to be clear about what it was, it said if you opposed the war, if you, quote, obstructed the war effort or the draft, you could be convicted of a felony and sent to a prison for 20 years. And some of the IWW leaders were, in fact, sentenced to 20 years, although they were finally pardoned after five. So that was a heavy sentence, 20 years, for just opposing the war. So
some would argue 5 years is a heavy sentence.
Absolutely. Yeah, maximum security prison, Fort Leavenworth. It was not a fun time, no.
I mean, it's not Woodrow Wilson who pardons these people. You have to wait until his term's over.
He did pardon some of them, but he didn't pardon IWW. He's a very vindictive person. That's one of the things that comes out in my book. And one of the things that really upset the progressives, even some pro-war progressives, they felt like once the war ended, it had ended, right? So release those guys who had been convicted under the Espionage Act. Wilson refused to do that with the IWW people. He refused to do that with Gene Debs as well. Just out of pure, in fact, Wilson told his chief of staff that Debs was a traitor for opposing the war.
Another question before we get into Eugene Victor Debs. The Espionage Act, is this the main legal justification for the suppression of dissent?
Yeah. On the federal level, that was true. The Espionage Act was the main thing that was used. They were also rounding up aliens, and that was another set of legislation. But for most of the people were U.S. citizens or in the process of becoming citizens, so they couldn't be rounded up like that. So, it was the Espionage Act was the primary thing at the federal level. On the state level, there were what were called criminal syndicalist laws, which were aimed at the IWW, and they said if you advocated a force in social change or sabotage in social change, you could be convicted of criminal syndicalism, and quite a few WOBs went to jail.
Well, that goes far beyond just opposing the war.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they were out to get the IWW.
What states were those?
Right.
Yeah, what states were those?
Oh, there were quite a few. I think it started in Idaho, but in California, they used it heavily. At one point, actually, one judge declared that just mere membership in the IWW is sufficient to go to jail. But usually they were tried under the criminal syndicalist laws.
Wow.
And that was the criminal syndicalist laws were the ones that the Supreme Court finally nullified in 1969 under Brandenburg, which is not, the primary statute, the case that still holds, which said that you couldn't go to jail just for advocating something, right? You had to actually, there had to be some immediate incitement to violence. And it's interesting that the law was formulated and used against the IWW primarily, but the case that went before the Supreme Court was around the Ku Klux Klan. So the Ku Klux Klan was finally the ones who ended the criminal syndicalist laws.
Because they were prosecuted just for their belief.
Yeah, for advocating, the state of Ohio argued if you're burning a cross, there's an implicit set of violence there. And so the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that that was not sufficient. You had to actually show that somebody immediately and in a direct way was inciting violence. You couldn't, because in the past, for instance, when the Communist Party was first organized in the immediate aftermath of World War I, they would have a pamphlet that said, sometime down in the future, it might be necessary to use violence to overthrow capitalism. And they would then be convicted for advocating violence, even though what they were saying was vaguely somewhere in the future, right? Somewhere in the distant, maybe possible. So that was the that's what the courts finally struck down. But it took until 1969, and it was a case involving the Klan, not involving either the CP or the IWW.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, interesting.
Let's turn to Eugene Victor Debs. This is okay. A great labor organizer. The late 19th and early 20th century, also perennial presidential candidate who would run with the socialist, who would run as a socialist. Isn't it 1920 that he runs for president again, but this time in a jail cell?
That's right.
Where he got
being convicted under the Espionage Act
and got nearly a million votes.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a lot more now than it would have been. Was a lot more then than it would have been now.
Oh yeah. 1912, he got 6% of the vote. And that was less than that in 1920 because women were voting then. But yeah, he was a very popular person. In fact, somebody wrote to Wilson, who was a pro-war socialist, and he said that there were three popular people in the United States: Woodrow Wilson, who wasn't in fact very popular, Theodore Roosevelt, and Eugene Debs. And he was probably right. Those were probably the most popular people in the United States.
What exactly did Eugene Victor Debs go to jail for?
Well, he went to jail for, he gave a speech in Canton, Ohio, in which he was pretty careful about what he said. Most of it is just general socialist stuff. And he opposed the Espionage Act and the suppression of dissent. But he did make it clear he opposed the war. Even though he very carefully worded it, it was a long speech, it was about an hour and a half. The government picked out a few sentences which indicated that he was, in fact, opposed to the war. He referred in passing to U.S. soldiers as cannon fodder, which was enough to get you sent to a prison. So anyway, they prosecuted him under the Espionage Act, and he served 2.5 years. I should point out he was quite old at the time, I think around 60, and he had heart problems. He was serving this in a high-security prison, so it really ruined his health.
Tell me about the campaign to try to get him free.
Yeah, so when he was in jail, it became a big issue. It became a big issue. And the Socialist Party, of course, was the first ones to jump on it because he was their presidential candidate. But after a while, more and more people got involved, progressives, even some people in Congress. So it became a real popular movement. And it was interesting, the split that happened, because the Socialist Party realized that to get Debs out of jail, it was impossible under Wilson. Wilson absolutely refused to even consider pardoning Debs. But Harding was a politico. He was a real shrewd politician. So it was to him as a pragmatic question. So the only way to get him to move on it was to put a lot of public pressure on him. And so they had petitions, and they talked about marches on Washington and that kind of stuff. And Samuel Gompers got involved, in 1920, after Debs had been in jail for a while. Gompers, the president of the American Federation of Labor, very much supported the war. But he wanted to sort of, burnish his credentials. And so he got on board with the Debs amnesty thing. But he put a lot of pressure on the Socialist Party and people around the Socialist Party not to demonstrate, to work within the system, to try and, control Harding within the system. So that chapter is about how that worked out. And it became a real intense split within the amnesty movement, and it left Debs in the middle. Debs was sitting in jail, of course, and he was hoping to see a unified amnesty movement. Instead, he found the two sides bitterly opposed to each other, and with the people like around Gompers saying those who organize demonstrations are actually hurting Debs because they're just antagonizing those in the administration. And I found it really interesting debate because it's the same kind of debate we often have these days. Do you work within the system? Do you work outside of the system? And it's often the case that those who are within the system and who claim to be sympathetic to you are telling you not to do something. Don't push too hard, because in doing that, you're going to antagonize those in power.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Eric Chester. Eric Chester is the author of the book, Free Speech and Suppression of Dissent During World War I. Eric Chester, how did the courts respond to all of this in the early years after the war, and even during the war, I guess?
Right. So generally, the courts upheld the prosecutions of those who opposed the war on the basis that a speech would have a tendency to encourage those who listen to it to violate the law by not, for instance, by not joining the army. So you, if you said something that was critical of the war effort, then you were undermining the possibility of people volunteering or even going along with conscription. So that most courts followed that all the way up to the Supreme Court. And under that, you know, basically the First Amendment was dead. I mean, if you can't say anything that criticizes the war during the wartime because it might undermine somebody's morale, you know, basically saying there's no free speech.
Well, we had a very different idea then of what the First Amendment meant for speech than we do today.
Yeah, absolutely. Came from the British, actually. It's the old common law British thing, which said that if a speech had the tendency to encourage somebody to violate the law, it was illegal. And under that, you know, it was really the government had carte blanche to squash its opposition. But what was interesting is as the war went on, and particularly in the after the war, when the government started going after communists, and this is the war had already ended, so they didn't have that rationale. Some of the pro-war progressives began pulling back and saying there has to be limits. There have to be limits on what the government can do, even during wartime. It's not just sufficient to say there's some general tendency towards someone encouraging someone to break the law. And it was out of that milieu, which actually came out of the New Republic, so the primary organ for that. It was out of that milieu that came the decisions at the Supreme Court level that created some check on what the government was doing, the clear and present danger doctrine that Oliver Wendell Holmes formulated. But it really came out of that milieu, which was saying, look, you know, we've seen what happens if we give Woodrow Wilson full power. He's vindictive. You know, people who are, you know, just even the most moderate opposition to the war, they can be prosecuted. You know, he's really just shutting down any debate whatsoever. That's going too far. And so even though they supported the war and even though they generally, supported the jailing of the IWW people, for instance, they felt it had gone too far. And it was out of that milieu that came the clear and present danger doctrine. And so that's one of the things I write about towards the end of the book. And my own feeling is that what we need is a definition of the First Amendment of free speech that is absolute, that says that where you have venues where people can discuss public policy issues, they have to be open to all. No matter how, you know, obnoxious an idea might seem, that it has a right to be heard. Because once you start cutting that down, once you're saying that idea is out of bounds, you've really weakened the whole argument, and you see it, and they'll sort of slice away further and further until you're left with nothing. That's what happened during World War One.
What do you think about our debate and discourse over free speech today?
Well, I'm worried that it's interesting talk about Debs, because Debs was a really interesting guy in the sense that he took it as given that his views and the views of the left would be popular. That the problem was merely to get them out to people, and the government was trying to obstruct that. But once they were out there, they would be found to be, you know, in the interest of working class people. And I'm afraid now too many people on the left are defensive, so they feel like that they're losing the battle, and therefore their one way out of that is to quash those they see as right wing threats. And I think that's the wrong direction to go in. I think that's the wrong way to go. It doesn't show confidence in your own views, and it also undermines free speech.
You're referring to what some people call cancel culture?
Yeah, I'm referring to people who say for instance, some right wing guy can't speak on campus because if you don't nip him in the bud now, fascism is around the corner. Well, you know, the Supreme Court used the same argument for the left in suppressing the left. They said, if you don't squash it now, it'll be a threat in the future.
Now, some people will argue, many people actually argue that, well, it's also someone's free speech right or right to free speech to go and try to protest somebody who is speaking on campus and even to express or to protest and call for, say, a network to fire, you know, some TV personality or pundit that they find agreeable. I mean, it's not the government that's actually doing the suppression of speech.
Yeah, these are complicated questions, but I mean, sort of, to go back to the campus thing, you have every right to protest, right? If you don't like what somebody says, stand outside, protest, wave signs, whatever, hand out flyers. A little heckling isn't so bad, but you know what really happens if they try and drown them out? Now, that's that you can't do. It doesn't matter whether it's the government or not. You know, if we believe in free speech, somebody has a right to present their views. If you don't agree with it, get up and present an alternative viewpoint. And I think that what underlying it is a lack of self-confidence in your own views. You really feel that this right-wing person, if you allow them to speak on campus, is going to sway a whole bunch of people? I doubt it very much. I think, on the contrary, if you handle it correctly, you might actually get more people politicized in a good kind of way that encourages debate rather than squashes it. In terms of boycotts, that's another whole set of questions. I mean, I think that if you don't like what a certain person says on TV or radio, you have the right to not listen to it, you know, and I guess to encourage other people not to listen to it. That seems to be a free speech right. But since these right wingers seem to have quite a large audience, I don't see that that's going to get you very far. But
we'll do it.
Yeah, I guess I also get concerned is we're also seeing people starting to lose their jobs because of unpopular opinions. And I wonder if that's a good place to be going, where employers can decide, we're going to keep you or not because we don't agree with your political opinions.
Yeah, but again, this is, you know, and historically it was used against the left. You had blacklists of union organizers. They were corporations wouldn't hire people who had been union activists in some other place, got fired, they tried to get another job. No, they couldn't do that because they were blacklisted. And of course, the left heavily opposed that. So it does seem sort of ironic to then turn it around and say, well, you know, if you have right-wing views, your employer has the right to fire you. No, I don't think so. Well, no matter what your views are, if you do your job, you should keep your job.
And it's complicated. I think about when Lou Dobbs had a show on CNN, and Lou Dobbs is one of those TV personalities who every night talked about the dangers of immigration. And there was a big campaign. They eventually were successful, immigrant rights activists, of pushing Lou Dobbs out of CNN through public pressure. And I think if we were to talk to those activists, they would say Lou Dobbs was doing extreme damage every night to people in this country, to immigrants in this country, by scapegoating them and just whipping up, malcontent towards immigrants. And this was basically the one thing we had to do. And the way we did it was by exercising our own First Amendment right to do all of that.
Well, again, I said, it seems to me you have a right to not listen to somebody, and I suppose you have a right to encourage other people not to listen to them. But the argument that you're going to stop anti-immigrant propaganda by getting rid of a CNN person seems to be naive, and say the least. I mean, the Fox News, it's obvious, right? So, you're not really going to succeed that way. But I think if you're a public figure, you have to take it that if people don't like your views, they will make an issue of it. That's part of being a public figure, as you are, right? So that's the way it is. If you're a public figure, you put yourself forward. You have a set of political views. People don't like it. They can try and not listen to you and encourage other people not to listen to you. It's not so much the First Amendment part about it. It's the politics that sort of bother me. You're not really... Look, the reason people are, we know this, right? The reason people are worried about immigration is they're worried about unemployment, they're worried about poverty, they're worried about social services declining, and they're an easy scapegoat. So why don't we actually organize a movement that can try and change society so that it provides employment, security, social services, all the things that we need, in which case there'll be a whole lot less enthusiasm for targeting immigrants.
Eric Chester has been our guest. Eric Chester is the author of the book that we've been in conversation about. It's called Free Speech and the Suppression of Dissent During World War I. Eric Chester, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you.
Okay, thanks.
And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Our engineer today is Jose Gonzalez. If you'd like to hear past shows, you could do so by going online to kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Chesrich, and I thank you for listening.
Who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children? Are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything?
James Baldwin, a voice synonymous with passion, integrity, and vision. No other station has been playing voices like these except KPFA.
You're listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online worldwide at kpfa.org.